You're listening to Kissinger Century here on BBC World Service. In his 100th year, Henry Kissinger is still thinking and writing about the state of the world. No one alive has spent longer as a diplomatic go-between and fixer. Before, he was the engineer of Richard Nixon's foreign policy in the White House, and ever since. The refugee from Nazi Germany became a Harvard academic, then the negotiator in Vietnam and the Middle East with China and Russia, whose interpretation of realpolitik brought him fame and power and a horde of fierce critics. This is James Naughtie, and I went to Kissinger's home in New England to talk about his new book, Leadership, and his life. There was only one way to begin. In a disordered world, how would he describe the age we're living in?
It's an age of simultaneous global transition. Upheaval in some parts, evolution in others, but none of the institutions very stable, and all of them in the process, international and many national, moving towards a yet unachieved destination.
That must mean that it is not just because of the fissure that runs through Ukraine, but for other reasons too, a dangerous time.
Yes, because even say in the Ukraine, different participants evaluate the importance of specific decisions unequally. So unevenness is not only in the way the issues appear, but in the evolution that they generate.
This brings us to the question of leadership, about which you've been thinking for, of course, many decades. And one of your great themes has always been that our history as individuals and as nations lives with us, and those memories shape us, and in a way should shape us.
History shapes decisions to the extent that you believe in the validity and in the quality of the past. If the whole social effort revolves around the question, how to overcome the past, the possibility of creative leadership towards the rest of the world becomes sharply constrained.
Kissinger's own past extends back to the destruction of Europe in war. Growing up in Germany, he was a witness to the Nazi era and the events that shaped his ideas about the world. The student whose PhD thesis was on the reordering of power in Europe after Napoleon still wrestles with that theme today. I took him back to his youth.
When you say I lived in Germany, and I did, but as a member of a discriminated minority.
In a Jewish family.
Many of our acquaintances were Jewish and suffered the same fate. The German Jewish community was more integrated into German society and thought more in characteristic German terms. So that then to be suddenly expelled and indeed lose civil rights, not being able to allowed to associate with Germans. I was 9 years old when Hitler came to power, and I remember somebody bringing a note into a teacher, and he announced that Hitler was now Chancellor. It had no impact on my life at that moment. But then my father, who was a title of Studienrat at the gymnasium, lost that job within weeks. And it wasn't the job so much as the status. That's how I lived in Germany. So my formation in the good experiences I had in Germany were during and after the war.
And you dismantled a Gestapo cell. You were decorated for it.
Yes. My division, the 84th Infantry Division, took over the city of Hanover. We were supposed to contribute to establishing order. So I was looking for people in the German population experienced in police work. And somebody came into my office and I said, "What's your experience?" He said, "Staatspolizei." And as a joke, I said, "Geheime Staatspolizei." Yeah. He said, "Jawohl, Geheime Staatspolizei." So I arrested him, and he was outraged. And I said, "Well, can you help me find your colleagues?" Which he did.
So that was your first coup?
So that was a coup where I got some credit for his work.
I have just returned from the Belsen concentration camp.
Eventually, the German Jew and American soldier found himself in his homeland, one of the liberators of a concentration camp.
I find it hard to describe adequately the horrible things that I've seen and heard.
There he saw even more clearly than before the cost of war.
It was a subcamp of Bergen-Belsen. And of course one had read about concentration camps. And I had not realized until I saw that camp, the depths to which human beings could be reduced. It's the institutionalized degradation, because these camps were organized hierarchically. That is to say, at the top in the camp were German professional criminals who had been sentenced to concentration camp after a certain number of convictions. But they were hierarchically the highest in food and so forth. And so it went down the list until you got to the Jews. Just ahead of the Jews were the Poles.
And in a way, that organization must have been one of the most horrifying aspects. The fact
exactly.
That it was so regimented. So the awfulness of the system was being perpetuated.
Perpetuated among prisoners who were fighting to survive.
That experience in army intelligence informed his writing and teaching as an academic in the 50s. Then government called. At the start of the 60s, President John F. Kennedy asked him to assess the West German Chancellor, Konrad Adenauer, the first of the six leaders discussed in his new book, Leadership.
Adenauer began with the conviction that German guilt had to be affirmed. But he also had the conviction that Germany would get back to equality, but that it could do so only through a period of accepting partition of the country. Some of its industry would be dismantled. And that some of this entry into European equality and institutions was achieved by executing these discriminatory provisions.
It's interesting because you talk, one of the other figures in the book on whom you focus is Charles de Gaulle, roughly Adenauer's contemporary in France. Now, you describe him as an illusionist. What do you mean by that?
He started with the conviction that France had this great, unique civilization, and that to bring this to the world was its great achievement. And he did that when France was on the floor, country had been occupied. He arrived in Britain without money, without the language, and managed to get appointed by Churchill as the leader of the Free French, which didn't exist.
Dis donc, le 14 juillet 1940 est un jour.
You talk of part of leadership, sometimes being a gift of something akin to prophecy, or the idea that you can give a clarion call.
Avec le concours des armes de la France.
That awakes a spirit and so on. And de Gaulle had a bit of that, didn't he?
He was not a pleasant man to meet necessarily, because his posture was that his vision was the one that would be implemented. And it certainly would not fail for lack of effort.
You tell a wonderful story in the book about a meeting with Nixon, with Richard Nixon and de Gaulle.
Nixon brought me to a meeting, and Nixon asked de Gaulle for a view of the future of Europe. And he made a magnificent presentation of countries that had been united and had failed, that had now to reconstitute themselves, and that France would never delegate its defense to foreign nations. So Nixon did not want to start by quarreling with de Gaulle. So he turned to me and said, "What do you think?" And I said, "This is a moving description of the situation as the president sees it. But how is he going to deal with Germany in the Europe that he has described?" And de Gaulle looked at me for a second and said, "Par la guerre," by war, implying next question.
That's all that needs to be said.
He was not going to elaborate on that.
You're listening to Kissinger's Century on BBC World Service. In France with Nixon, the president with whom he forged a powerful relationship as National Security Advisor and then Secretary of State. Nixon was elected in 1968 with the United States fighting a war in Vietnam that divided Americans at home and became the beacon for protest among the young across the Western world. It had to end. Nixon needed a foreign policy fixer, and he summoned Kissinger.
I thought this would be an informational meeting. We spent 2 hours talking about international affairs without him saying anything about any position. Then a week later, I received a phone call, and John Mitchell said, "Well, are you going to take the job or not?" And I said, "What job?" And I heard him mutter something that sounded like, "Oh my God, he screwed it up again." And the reason is Nixon had a fundamental fear of being rejected. On the other hand, he was perfectly able and always willing to take the tough decision as long as he didn't have to overrule somebody face to face. So what I'm describing is not weakness. It is a conflict, a permanent conflict.
Nixon's character was one of the most puzzling pictures of leadership Kissinger would ever see. It produced surprises.
"The only answer to communism is a massive offensive for freedom. Freedom from hunger, from disease. And a victory for the..."
Once a red-baiting anti-communist crusader, Nixon now wanted to heal the rift with Mao Zedong, aging hero of the communist revolution in China. The countries hadn't talked for decades. Kissinger set to work in secret.
None of this was done by cable on either side. We sent our messages on unmarked paper without signature, and they send it with an emissary. So every exchange took about 2 weeks. It was like 19th century. They were all procedural, all these exchanges. We stayed away from getting into a deadlock on substance. So the first Chinese message was that they would be prepared to talk about the return of Taiwan. We replied, we are prepared to talk about an agenda in which each side could raise whatever subject it considered most important. They accepted that in the return and then moved it into a technical discussion.
And so eventually to Mao himself, unbending autocrat, commander of the brutal and bloody Cultural Revolution of the 60s, all-powerful, and to the West, a figure of mystery as well as fascination. Kissinger had to try to understand him.
Undoubtedly, a man who mastered such an agenda and who had the brutality to inflict whatever sacrifices were necessary was a complex person. I had 5 meetings with him altogether, and unlike almost any other leader, he always, in meetings with me, began with a question. And then he would ask needling additional questions in response.
The complexity of that leadership must have opened new vistas for you.
At first, he was exclusively interested, in lining us and China up vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And he'd give me fatherly advice how to keep Japan in that combination. As time went on, he wanted us in an open alliance, while my view, of course, Nixon's view was that we should always be closer to China and Russia than they were to each other.
That's a consistent theme which persists in your mind to today, doesn't it?
Yes.
The overture to China was in itself revolutionary. But for Kissinger and Nixon, this wasn't an idealistic rewriting of history, rather an engagement with the world as it was, realpolitik. Dealing with China would continue to be controversial, whether after the massacre in Tiananmen Square in the 1980s or today, with the Uyghur minority facing persecution. Kissinger's long-time approach has many critics, but that's who he is.
In the model of foreign policy that we were attempting to pursue, we did not tie it to the vision that we would convert 1 billion people to a different philosophy. So we had no illusions of overthrowing Mao. And for the foreseeable future, we were dealing with a communist system. I really believe that we face that problem today, not just with China, but with the world. What is it we're trying to achieve? The conversion of a society to a different view, which is of course desirable, but if it is the main exercise of your diplomacy, you lose contact with other realities and you have no great criteria by which to apply it. For somebody with my background, of course democracy is superior to dictatorship. I've lived in a dictatorship. But for a statesman, his obligation is to move his society to a world less prone to catastrophe, more capable of achieving common objectives.
The expedition to China was high drama. The Middle East was a long and difficult slog. The Six-Day War in 1967 had pitched Israel against the Arab world, and the region was sunk in ugly hostility. Then in 1973, Egypt launched a surprise offensive in the war called Yom Kippur, because the attack came on that Jewish holy day.
Like Winston Churchill, President Anwar Sadat has only been acclaimed by his people as a great leader since he became a war leader and the first Arab in 25 years to force the Israelis to retreat in battle.
Yet from his book, it's clear that Anwar Sadat of Egypt is one of the leaders whom Kissinger most admires. Why?
He started the Yom Kippur War, which no Western observer believed at the time the Egyptians were capable of doing.
No one will capitulate here in this country. I'm not ready to capitulate or to surrender one inch.
He sent us a message on the second day of the war in which he said, at the end of the war, I expect a negotiation towards peace.
And you believed him?
I believed that he was willing to negotiate. But I didn't know what kind of a negotiating partner he would be.
Kissinger embarked on what became known as shuttle diplomacy between the warring parties. To the newspapers, he was Super K, jetting back and forth from one capital to the other. And Sadat surprised him.
He sat down and said, I've come here to negotiate peace. And I have looked forward to a chance to explore it. So I have prepared a Kissinger plan. And he walked over to a map and he said, here is my idea of a Kissinger plan. And his Kissinger plan demanded that 3/4 of the Sinai be returned to Egypt. So that was impossible. On the other hand, it contained the single most important concession and above all transformation. Because up to then, the formal Arab position was that there would be no negotiation.
Henry Kissinger, the diplomatic go-between and advisor to American presidents since John F. Kennedy, is in his 100th year. This is James Naughtie, and I've been to Henry Kissinger's home in New England in the United States to talk about his new book, Leadership, and about some of the leaders he's known. Despite winning the Nobel Prize for reaching a peace agreement, the most controversial part of his career was over the American war in Vietnam and the extension of the conflict into neighboring Cambodia. He has never wavered in his argument that it was necessary for the United States to expand the war in order to end it.
The war in Vietnam presented itself to Nixon as 500,000 American troops already being in place and 50,000 in the pipeline when he became president, with 30,000 casualties having already been suffered. And the debate in America had become so embittered that President Johnson couldn't appear in public except on military bases. A significant part of the American elite had become convinced that a defeat was better for the American soul than a continuation of the war.
One of the consequences of that was, of course, that the administration felt it couldn't tell Congress about what was going on across the border in Cambodia and Laos. Do you regret that now?
That was a mistake.
They should have been told.
The reaction would have been the same. It was naive to believe that you could conduct a clandestine military operation.
The other thing that people always throw at you is the Chilean coup in 1973. Do you regret anything about that, you know, the American engineering effectively of a coup to remove a government which you didn't like?
It's always important to remember the context. Allende had come to power through a peculiarity in the constitution, where the party with the largest number of votes, even if it was an overall minority, would be gaining office. But there was an interval between the election and the time that the Congress would act, in which the Chilean parliament would choose the president. So we were trying to influence that election, which American administrations had done periodically. That was not an invention of Nixon. The coup occurred 4 years later. We were not involved in the coup directly.
But there was indirect American involvement. You say nothing direct, but...
Yeah, but we were not in the coup period itself. We did not deplore Allende's overthrow. We were very satisfied with it. And we supported Pinochet after he had established himself.
It was an authoritarian state with a different kind of name about it.
No question, authoritarian state.
Chile, Vietnam, the Middle East, and in the middle of it all, Nixon. The president who, as Kissinger puts it, spent his life in a heroic struggle with himself. By 1973, early in his second term, his dark side, the dirty political fighter obsessed with his enemies, had plunged him into Watergate. This third-rate burglary, as the White House called it, mushroomed into a scandal about secrecy, law-breaking and the abuse of power. And it was to Kissinger, as Secretary of State, that Nixon eventually had to write his formal letter of resignation, the only such letter ever written.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
Inside the White House, Kissinger had watched a presidency come apart.
I saw Nixon every day while he was going through this. He almost never raised these issues with me, except in a description of what he was going through. You have to remember, here is this man from an unlikely background, raising himself with fantastic willpower against his own predilections to eminence.
Finally on this, I just want to ask you, how did your relationship with him and your view of him develop after he left office in 1974?
I do not say he was a likable person in the normal sense, because he was always defending himself, protecting himself. But over the years, I developed a feeling of warmth for him. And as I look back on his presidency, he taught or tried to teach America an important lesson, namely that one cannot construct international relations like personal relations, because one is dealing with the destiny of societies, and that unfolds over a long period.
You seem to be of the view that there is much in the tone and the practice of politics now in this country, which it makes it very, very difficult to have the kinds of conversations that you want to hear about the outside world.
Yes, this is one current in American thinking. There's another current which is militarily missionary, and great things have been achieved by that attitude. But they were based on the fact that America was very dominant at the period. Now we're in a period that has one unique aspect, and that is that technology has become so sophisticated and so overpowering that I would state it as a basic principle of countries with high-tech equipment and high-tech industry that the one limiting principle of their foreign policy should be to avoid a high-tech war.
From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Enter the disruptor. All Kissinger's thinking about American policy was challenged by the arrival in 2016 of a president in Donald Trump with no obvious interest in history or international relations, a NATO skeptic, a tycoon for whom foreign policy was just more deal-making. Yet, still, the call came from the Oval Office.
His view would be the strength of his personal relationship would play a big role in his assessment. And he had the established conservative view that there was a strong adversarial aspect. My view would have been that personal relations, while somewhat important, cannot be decisive, because human life is shorter than the life of societies, and that therefore Russia needed to be resisted where it threatened the international system or where it threatened our national interests. And of course, in my mind, the national interest of America and the Atlantic interest are closely intertwined. That was less pronounced in Trump's view.
It brings us to Putin himself. You've known him for a long time.
I met Putin when he was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. And I met him at a lunch where, because somebody had failed to produce an interpreter, Putin and I were engaged because we could talk German to each other.
What do you make of him?
Intelligent, driven by a kind of mystic view of Russia. Not an ideological view that others could share, but of Russia's unique capacity to survive across many time zones and many enemies around them by the faith of the Russian people in themselves, deploring what had been taken away from Russia through the collapse of the Soviet Union. So it was not a Hitlerian view of conquest, but a very firm view about the essence of Russian reality. And so, for example, Ukraine was not just a successor state, but something carved out of the Russian entity.
Of course, the irony here is that by his invasion of Ukraine, Putin has created exactly the kind of national consciousness through President Zelensky, who's been able to express it, that he insisted had not existed before.
Yes, and it makes it inconceivable that his original war aim of returning Ukraine to a state of dependence on Russia can ever come out of this war except by a Russian military victory.
When Kissinger spoke recently about how a deal with Russia might emerge, he was accused of promoting a sellout. President Zelensky of Ukraine even compared him to the appeasers of Nazi Germany. Friends say that, not surprisingly, that reference to Munich, the agreement in the very year that the Kissinger family left Germany, upset him. So for BBC World Service, I asked him to clarify his view.
What we are seeing in Ukraine right now is something peculiar to this period, namely that two nuclear powers with the capacity to incinerate the region are fighting with the personnel of a European state, and that the limits, therefore, are not fully established by them. And secondly, that the war has implications, that at the beginning of wars there's often great unanimity, but when the implications are fully faced, divisiveness appears. And then, how do you relate war aims to a conclusion? I thought that if the status quo ante were reached, it would have been demonstrated that an attack on an existing European entity by resistance of its people, aided by other Europeans and Americans, had been thwarted geographically. This means that territory that Ukraine controlled when the war started would be restored, and that's about 95%. The other 5% were acquired by Russia 10 years earlier by European acquiescence. And I think it is important to keep the war about freedom of Ukraine from becoming a war about the security of Russia.
But there are many European leaders who say Putin must not be allowed to get away with it. And they might say, here you are, Henry Kissinger. You're saying, in the end, let's make sure that Putin is not humiliated, because that is more important.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying I believe that Putin's position in Russia will be very precarious and probably not maintainable over a substantial period of time. I think that most European leaders that I know, in my opinion, agree with what I said. Putin cannot think he got away with anything if his objective to subjugate the Ukraine has been defeated. Europe acted in unison. Ukraine has been established as a viable European state. Northern Europe has been unified inside NATO. And the argument about whether Ukraine should be part of NATO has been practically resolved, because there's no way of going back to that position.
In that sense, you're suggesting that it has been all but settled.
No, I think if the war is ended on the present line, and therefore most of Donbass and much of the Black Sea coast remains Russian, that in the end it will be perceived as a Russian success. So I would consider that a defeat. I would think if that happened, so that the new dividing line is at the limit of the current Russian advance, that would be a very unfortunate.
So they need to be pushed back further, in your view?
They have to be pushed back to the borders that they had before. That would be a defeat for Russia. Russia would have been diminished in that sense. But the key, in my mind, would then be now a dialogue between Europe, NATO and Russia, might establish a stabler system.
Is that possible with Putin still in power?
I don't believe Putin will be in power when that evolves, partly because of longevity in office. This is the objective I would seek, even if Putin were in power, but it's not what I would prefer.
The president said the United States was willing to use force to defend Taiwan against any Chinese aggression. China responded to the president's
comments. To look at another problem, which is not burning at the moment, but is smouldering, we go back to China and Taiwan. What lies ahead for Taiwan?
The essence of the Taiwan relationship is that for Chinese, Taiwan is an inextricable part of the Chinese system. So when we re-establish relations, on the one hand, we accepted the concept of one China, and on the other hand, the Chinese accepted a long period of evolution, which Mao described as even 100 years. So how to handle this period? And in my opinion, which is not the accepted opinion, constant confrontations over Taiwan have the exact opposite effect, because the more we affirm Taiwan as a second China, and the more the Chinese feel they have to reply to that, and the more armed forces are built up around it, the more tense the situation becomes. Neither country should be asked to give up its basic principle explicitly. America has made clear that a violent attack on Taiwan would mean significant American reaction.
It would mean war.
But to answer this question the way it was done publicly recently is exactly what may produce the situation. If one could cool the rhetoric and watch the actions, if military action takes place, then we have a decision to make, which must be overwhelmingly influenced by what has gone on. But if Taiwan becomes a subject of domestic intense interest in both countries explicitly, the tension can only get worse.
He opened the door to China 50 years ago this year. Now, as he told me for BBC World Service, he sees Taiwan as the most dangerous flashpoint in the world and thinks the West still has to decide how to engage with a strong and expansionist China.
We will have to develop a concept of dealing with China that can be maintained over an indefinite period of time. It can change with every administration. With respect to Europe, we formed a concept of Atlantic Partnership in the 40s that proved its sustainability and its importance for over a generation. We don't have that in relation to Europe now. I don't think that Europe has up to now faced the Chinese issue as a strategic problem. They have dealt with it more as an economic problem.
When he was writing about post-Napoleonic Europe more than 60 years ago, studying the likes of Metternich and his concept of the balance of power, Kissinger was also writing a script for his own life in diplomacy. Formerly in the White House, and ever afterwards as a broker and negotiator, the man who knows everyone. Just as all American presidents used to summon the evangelist Billy Graham for a public show of spiritual contemplation, so Kissinger plays the same role in foreign affairs. It means that even in his 100th year, he's writing and talking and being listened to.
above all, about the danger of a world in which alliances and understandings give way to a narrow definition of self-interest, with potential consequences that have never been more threatening.
The unique feature of the present world is that the confrontational aspect of international affairs, which is prerequisite to the ability to do anything else, has become inconceivably dangerous and in some respects out of control even of leaders. And one needs a conceptual approach how both to be strong but to conduct a serious dialogue. The view that the whole world is uniformly going to share the same notion of legitimacy has not been proved by events, and it's even harder to prove in the future. What I said in this book is a recognition that decoupling is happening, both philosophically and economically and in the way of conduct. But paradoxically, what we are now asking of leaders, or what the situation asks of leaders, is that they are wise in seemingly antithetical concepts. And we have no training in that.
Democracy and autocracy are bound to have to live side by side.
I'm not saying autocracy must always survive. I'm just saying that among democracies, the confrontational aspect is at least reduced, if not eliminated. But a realistic assessment of where the world is going, they will have to live side by side for the rest of this century in some way. And for that, a new mentality has to be created. Not between those who want peace and others who want war, but between those who are prepared to defend, but also prepared to accommodate within the limits that their values permit. That's very hard to achieve because it means that within each country you need enough confidence in each other so that you can live with decisions because you have confidence that over a long period of time the society will hold together.
Countries need confidence in each other to survive together. That's the never-ending quest that has been the theme of a life in times of war and occasional peace. This time next year, Henry Kissinger will be 100, leaving him in his library, a leafy New England scene spreading out around us. He was getting ready for lunch with the Chinese ambassador and his retinue. A diplomat to the end. Thank you for listening to Kissinger's Century here on BBC World Service, presented by me, James Naughtie, and produced by Giles Edwards.
Now, future errors will be eradicated. Defeats will become victories. You have changed the future of the universe, Doctor.
I have betrayed the future. Davros, for the last time, consider what you're doing. Stop the development of the Daleks.
Impossible. It is beyond my control. The workshops are already fully automated to produce the Dalek machines.
It's not the machines. It's the minds of the creatures inside them. Minds that you created. They are totally evil.
Evil? No! No, I will not accept that. They are conditioned simply to survive. They can survive only by becoming the dominant species. When all other life forms are suppressed, when the Daleks are the supreme rulers of the universe, then you will have peace. Wars will end. They are the power not of evil, but of good.
Davros, if you had created a virus in your laboratory, something contagious and infectious that killed on contact. A virus that would destroy all other forms of life. Would you allow its use?
It is an interesting conjecture.
Would you do it?
The only living thing, a microscopic organism, reigning supreme. A fascinating idea.
But would you do it?
Yes. Yes. To hold in my hand a capsule that contained such power. To know that life and death on such a scale was my choice. To know that the tiny pressure on my thumb, enough to break the glass, would end everything. Yes. I would do it. That power would set me up above the gods. And through the Daleks, I shall have that power!